We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Guys, Bob Morano's back. Every day's feast day. We're going to answer your questions. But before we get to it, oh, by the way, this is the Full Blast Podcast, and I am Jeff Fader. Let's take care of a little business. First things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder and more. Go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10 for 10% off everything. These guys are awesome. Had a great time at Blade Show with them, and they got big things coming up, which I'm very proud of for them, and I'm glad that we can be part of their orbit. You know what I'm saying? Next are my friends at Even Heat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. I swear by it. All the different types of materials that I'm hardening, I have to use an Even Heat. Whatever steels need a specific temperature, this is the one for you. To go to evenheat-kiln.com and check it out. I cannot thank my friend Lawrence Lake at Maritime Knife Supply enough. He was fantastic. What a great host. He's just terrific, and he's a facilitator. And he also has a company called Maritime Knife Supply. And all your knife-making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, press, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. They're in Canada, and they ship to the United States with ease. He's very, very, he's been very, very helpful to me in regards to understanding how tariffs work. And you'd be surprised at, you know, what you can and can't do with coming in and out of Canada. But he's been fantastic, and he's a facilitator, like I said. So go to MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, and if you buy a 10-pack of abrasive belts, he puts 10% off on that. Once again, just a fantastic guy. I had such a great time with him, and he's unbelievable. Next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stabroil knife finishing vise and more. They teach classes. They also sell T4 Sentinel oil. And I got a nice message from Carl from Tormek, who said, I went down to Trojan Horse Forge, and I'm not too far from them, and they're unbelievable. They're unbelievable because they're unbelievable. And if you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off everything at TrojanHorseForge.com. Their Stabroil knife finishing vise is the best. I just got a new package from my friends at Baker Forge. Baker Forge makes the great steels, different types of steels, bronze my, copper my, sand my, all those different types of really exotic steels that are going to put some boom bang in your ding dong. And if you go to bakerforge.com and you put in the promo code Full Blast, you can get 10% off everything, but including their etchant Gator Piss, which you can also get at Texas Ferris. I'm going to talk about them in a minute. But they just sent me something pretty cool that they had a Blade Show, and now they're going to be having it. It's called Gator Skin. It's a nano ceramic coating. This is for your carbon steel knives, for your Damascuses, for your Baker Forge steel. It's a pretty interesting thing. It minimizes friction for smoother cutting performance, extends edge retention for precision, simplifies maintenance, FDA compliant for food contact, apply ultra thin for sleek, durable finish, safe, environmentally friendly material, ensures long-term durability without reapplication. All you have to do is clean the blade thoroughly, post-etching, degrease it, spray and wipe a thin, even coat, and then it dries in 20 minutes, full cure at 24 hours. For tutorials, tips and tricks, go to gatorpiss.shop. And this stuff is awesome, and I'm really looking forward to trying it out. But Coy and the guys know what they're doing, and I support them. And the Gator Piss family is unbelievable. And Gator Piss, awesome. Gator Piss Max, unbelievable. Gator Piss Heavy, can't beat it. So definitely go over to them. And then if you want, you can also go to my guys over at Texas Ferry Supply, and they have all that. They have the Gator Piss, And if you put in the promo code KnifeTalk10 at TexasFairySupply.com, you get 10% off everything. That's where I get my Rhino Wet, ladies and germs, because I want to get that 10% off. You know, Rhino Wet's the best sandpaper there is, and I don't want to pay full price. You know what I mean? So go to TexasFairySupply.com and load up that cart with whatever you got and tip. Get the 220, get the 800, get the 400. You're in good shape, and then get that Knife Talk 10 to peel off 10% off. So TexasFairySupply.com. Just got off the phone with Total Boat. Kristen and I are going to do something at – well, Total Boat and I are going to do something at Maker Camp this year. So if you go to Maker Camp, I'm going to be doing a demo with Total Boat. I'm going to be probably using their two-part epoxies. We're going to be talking about their dies. We're going to be talking about their Fathom Thick Set. We are going to do some interesting things they'll talk about in the future. But if you like to use epoxy, if you're a knife maker or you're trying to put stuff together, definitely get that two-part high-performance epoxy. I love it. The UV Cure resin is great, and the CA glue is amazing. Just they sent me a pile of it. And they'll give you enough quart containers to hydrate yourself in the kitchen. They send you so many quart containers, it's slightly shocking. Next, my friends at GL Hansen & Sons, that's g.l.hansen&sons on Instagram, or you can go to gcarter.bigcartel.com to see what the fuss is about. I love these guys. Greg is amazing. He just sent me a pile of stuff, trout-colored handle scales. It's a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed with epoxy under pressure and heat. This stuff is awesome. You know the names. I've said it a million times, but I'm telling you, people are starting to ask for it by name. I cannot get enough of the GL Hansen & Sons. So go get yourself some scales there. And when you put in the promo code, no promo code, when you go over there to gcarter.bigcartel.com, you're supporting a small business, artists, supporting a small business. Next, my friends at Tormek. My guys at Tormek. Tormek just sent me another machine. I've gotten so tight with these guys. Four T8s. One of them's really on the fritz. One of them I've been using for 10 years, and it's just like I beat the brakes off of it. And they were just like, I sent Carl a video of what it sounded like. He's like, I'm sending you a new one. You can't be dealing with this. So I love Tormek. I love them. I love those guys. We spent some time together at, I got so many nice messages from people who were at Blade Show who got to meet Sebastian and Jake. Jack and Carl and Dave. Those guys are amazing. And if you want to learn how to sharpen, it's going to make you a great sharpener, but it's also going to make you a really great knife maker. If you're a knife maker looking to kind of dial in your edge, dial in your geometry, Tormek really does a great job. You can use jigs. You don't have to use jigs. I'm with them. And many thanks to my guys over at Tormek. And go to Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. Next, my friends at Nordic Edge. Got to see Jamie at Blade Show. Jamie Sausage Man Forge was representing Nordic Edge. And they're amazing. Not only do they sell great products, but they also teach. They teach blacksmithing, leatherworking, spoon carving, all that stuff. So if you're interested in, if you're in Australia and you're interested in getting all the stuff I'm talking about, but you don't want to spend that dough, you want to, you know, test the waters, you go over to nordicedge.com.au, and they're teaching great classes, and they're great guys. They also sell lots of products on their website. They sell lots of stuff to get you squared away if you're a knife maker. Or a blacksmith. They have all that stuff, and they teach amazing classes. So definitely 100% on nordicedge.com.au. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Phoenix Abrasives. That's phoenixabrasives.com. They're suppliers of superior abrasive products for every application. I was just on their website. They have a wide array of different types and different companies. It's almost like they have all the belts for everything you need for a metal fabrication, glass fabrication, floor sanding, obviously knife making. They got belts, they got grinding discs, cutting discs, lap disc, all that stuff from different companies and different suppliers. And if you put in the promo code FB10 at checkout, you're going to get 10% off your entire order. So many thanks to Phoenix Abrasives. I really appreciate your support. I have been waiting for this day. My man, Bob Morano, is back. Bob is unbelievable. He was here a couple months ago, and he has an amazing social media profile, and like he's created this amazing network of people and followers, and it's called Every Day is Feast Day. Bob Morano's my guy. Bob, how the hell are you?
I'm great. I'm glad to be back. I'm looking forward to this one. I've been excited for it.
Oh, I'm so glad. We had such a good time. I got so many nice messages when you were on here before. And if you're listening to Bob for the first time, you're you're crazy. Go back into the archives and listen to his first episode. We got a lot to cover, a lot of ground to cover. Bob is an incredible chef, but he's an incredible, approachable teacher. He's on TikTok, he's on Instagram, he's on Facebook, he's on everywhere you can get. He's got very, very easy to follow, approachable recipes that you can do and you can cook at home, and he's not talking down to you. It's approachable. It's fantastic. I love everything you do.
Well, thanks a lot. You hit the nail on the head. My goal in doing this is like to try to help people learn how to cook, make food more approachable. And like you said, I get some of the most wonderful comments also of just people that make the recipes, or they go, oh, I learned this, or somebody, I get fellow food industry people now that are following. And one of the better, like, I got a comment once saying that, that it was a cheat code for line cooks. And like stuff like that to me is just, it means so much, because like, that's where I come from. And it's like, approval of your own peers. I love all the comments, and I love all the industry comments. And also the people that maybe like, oh, I got into cooking, or me and my son now, we make a pizza at home, or all that stuff is just amazing. It makes me feel good. I love that stuff.
You should, I've known you for a while before this massive explosion. And I always loved the fact that you were very diligent with how you did your videos. You were the sound is always good. The lighting's always good. You're very, very organized in how you're, creating what you're doing. And it is pretty amazing. I will tell you, this weekend, I was with some friends and a friend from college. And he was talking. He's like, it's so amazing. You're working with all these celebrities. That guy, Every Day's Feast Day, is unbelievable. And he was like, Bob is a celebrity. You are in this world. I've had a few people have lumped you in with a number of celebrity chefs that I work with, and they see you as a celebrity.
It is bizarre, because obviously I don't see myself as that, but it is, when you look at followings of other people or different Food Network people or something like that, there are people that my following is larger or around the same, but it's definitely bizarre. But I'm glad, I'm glad that people are finding this stuff and using it. I mean, that's the biggest compliment that I can get in making this stuff, is that people are using this stuff.
I would say what's the best part is, I feel as though, and this might be like this, what I'm saying to you might be from when you had under 200,000 followers. I think that there's a difference between the answers or the comments you get on your social media. Facebook is a little bit more hostile than, and something I wanted to talk to you about is, I feel as though the majority of the things that people say are very supportive and positive.
That's correct.
Sub 200,000 followers. Now you're getting into like the crackpot situation.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about it last time, but it's one of those things where like when you're making content, like I try to make it almost daily. I'm doing at least 5-6 days a week. But when you're making that much content, you get videos that appeal to certain people and don't appeal to other people. And then just like the nature of the beast is that you'll make a video every once in a while that just skyrockets into the stratosphere of like millions of views. And when you're in those numbers, it's just a certain percentage that are going to be, you might get nasty comments or disagree. It's just kind of the nature of what it is. But it's definitely, it's very interesting. I find it interesting. Yeah.
Have you noticed between Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram a different type of like commenter, or is there like as kind of a similarity?
They definitely have their nuances, I would say. Facebook, there's a lot more, I would say there's a lot more bickering going on in the comment section in Facebook, as far as like people going back and forth between each other. That happens a lot on Facebook.
Yeah.
TikTok is usually comment heavy, but not necessarily in a negative way. It can, it can go that way. And many times it can take if somebody finds a reference in a video that they'll comment about, that that reference could relate to other people. And then that creates, a conversation of whatever they were talking about, things like that. But I would definitely say they have little nuances, like subtle nuances.
I would think, in my mind, I've always thought that the Facebook user is an older audience, and that I've always felt that way, just because I know that like my older family relatives aren't about to just, they can't handle starting one new social media platform. So I always thought that Facebook were kind of an older user. So they might have a different approach to how they respond to you.
Yeah, I would say that you're somewhat correct. Surprisingly, I have a very similar metrics as far as the following that I have on Facebook and on TikTok. I find like a large crossover of the age, sort of the age and gender profiles that you have access to that are very similar on both TikTok and Facebook together. I think Facebook has definitely been around longer, you know, so those users exist. They've been on that platform for a long period of time. But Facebook is almost having a reinventing moment, I feel. And then TikTok has kind of been around long enough to where it's kind of caught on with some of the older, especially in your food creation and your crafts. You know, there's everything from knitting to just like every other platform. But I think people have had enough time now to also gravitate towards TikTok being essentially all video content. It's like almost mini YouTube.
It's, you know, you introduced me to the chef. I talked about him last episode a little bit. Real Chef Thompson.
Oh, yes. Yep.
He's fantastic. And he's just been like, I really enjoy his style and your style are so different because you're really giving people like a very compact, easy to digest recipe, or not even just a recipe, a style or an avenue in which to kind of create something that can go many different ways. You're giving someone like the foundation for a meal that can be, you know, replicated or changed or whatever. What he does is he shows you what he does during the day. And he was really generous with me. He got one of our collaboration knives. We still, if you go to faderknives.com, Bob and I, we still have the collaboration knives available. And 10% is going to Sparrow's Nest, which has been a really great opportunity. And at the end of this, we're going to talk. We got something new coming up, but that's to be talked about later. But what's interesting is I feel as though the types of comments that he gets are so far different than the comments you get. To the point you and I have talked about it before, I feel like that there's like a real hostility towards him. Targeted to the certain, there's people say things to him that are just cruel, like, you know, you shouldn't be a cook or you plateaued, or it just seems like it's just nasty, nasty spirited towards him versus, I mean, you get some goofball that says something just weird about what you're cooking, but not that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And I think like you said, we talked about it a little bit before. I think one of the things where like I have followed him long before I even started making content, at least to the level that I'm doing it now. But like I came from a place of, you know, the past probably two decades plus of cooking professionally every day, you know, in professional kitchens, paying for my house, my food. Like I cook professionally for a living. And he sort of got into content. He kind of made the jump. He went, I want to learn how to cook and cook in professional kitchens. I'm going to jump in with both feet and sort of document my journey on what this looks like, me getting into the food industry. And so like, I love his stuff so much because even early on, as somebody who does it for a living, I've managed young cooks and I've seen the journey that young cooks come in, you know, so I've been on the receiving end of him essentially. And I love that he just posts, when he messes up, when he learns something, when he doesn't learn something, when there's an opportunity for something, he posts all this stuff and makes it available to people to see. And I think that right there, especially on social media, might open the door to some negativity or people who, you know, I mean, you never know. Maybe somebody had a bad day. Maybe yesterday their dog died. Maybe you never know where these people are coming from or what sort of state of mind they are in when they're going through social media. But one thing that I love about Chef Thompson also is that, I mean, the dude has like 2 million followers, almost 2 million followers, I think, on TikTok. So it's like, you know, he doesn't stop. He gets comments and comments and comments. He continues to put, I mean, he's making multiple pieces of content a day, putting up multiple videos a day, continuing to share his, you know, he's currently on this like barbecue and smoker path where he's like working with these big giant smokers and he's putting up like, you know, he tries to start a fire and it has a trouble starting a fire or whatever the case is. He still continues to push out content and he's sort of just like, this is what I'm doing. And you know, I can't say if he cares or not, or if this stuff affects him or not, but he's not stopping. You know, he's continuing to put this content out for people.
In the blacksmithing community, I have every so often, every month or so, I have my friend Pat Quinn. He's the director of the Center for Metal Arts. And social media has been amazing because I met him through social media. You know, I've been following for at least 10 years. And the most amazing thing with artists is, generally speaking, if you like art, it's hard to be able to, in real time, watch the development of an artist. Like, you go to a museum, maybe you see a guy's painting, but maybe you won't have the ability in real time to watch them grow where they came from. Social media has given the opportunity for people to watch an artist or a craftsperson grow in real time. And people don't realize what a gift this is, because like I can now look back on my friend Pat's hammers, hit the evolution between his hammers from 7 years ago to now are striking based off of his experience. And when people don't understand that what Chef Thompson is doing is giving you this rare opportunity to watch the growth of a person in real time, as opposed to telling them, you know, give it up, you suck at this or whatever. It's just so, there's no perspective.
Yeah. That's 100% correct. It's like, and I can talk specifically about the food industry because that's where I come from. But like anyone who has spent time in the food industry, we all, like I have, when I was a young cook, I got yelled at and things thrown at me and I still burn myself, but you know, his content is real.
Yeah.
So it's like these, you know, people who have a problem with that, people can have a problem with whatever they want, but what he's making is real. I mean, it's just what it is. I mean, we have all been in that place if you have spent time in the food industry. So I think, like, for me anyway, when I see his pieces of content, I find that sort of charm in there, and that he's showing everyone. And it's like, whether it's food or not food, we all, everybody stubs their toe and everybody, whatever the case is, like, nobody wakes up every single morning and has like a 100% perfect nailed day every day. You know what I mean?
Oh, I give him a lot of credit. You know, a lot of knife makers, the funny thing is like, you know, what you do and what Chef Thompson does, you guys are creating content. And like in his situation, he's monetizing it. For knife makers, we're trying to sell our product. So showing mistakes for a potential customer isn't necessarily the best idea. It does give you like some perspective on who's making what you're doing. But it's in terms of creating a social media profile as like an advertisement for your work, it might not be the greatest idea of all time. That's debatable. So
it is, yeah, and I can see it.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the hard part. Like, I tend to, you know, I like to do bloopers and stuff like that, but like, I'm not going to show you my bad days because I don't want people to, you know, ultimately my customers, I want my customers to know that, you know, I got this all under control, you know? But it's that's a personal. I'm also 51, Bob. I can only do so much. I can only do so much self-deprecation on my own, you know?
Of course, yeah. But even the fact that you continue to make mistakes and you continue, it is a sign in itself of like pushing to learn and pushing your own skill set to places where you go, maybe I'm not there yet. Maybe I didn't. You make a mistake and you discover something that like, oh, I didn't realize this existed for me in this moment, but it's like this learning thing. And I think, I can see what you're saying. Like you said, it's debatable because, you know, to every single customer, it may not be valuable, but also to people, you know, whether it be, I think in your arena, maybe custom knife makers or that kind of niche, to me, I enjoy it as somebody like, you know, it's the cheesiest of cheese, but like, you know, food essentially is art. You know, you're making edible art. It's creative. It just is what it is. It sounds cheesy, whatever. But I love that peeks into other people who are creative, like the mindset or like something that you think is cool, like a knife handle that you really dig or a watercolor that you did that you really love. I love that peek into like your creative mindset.
It's interesting, and it's also kind of tough too, because what you're also trying to do is not trying to confuse people. You know, I don't monetize social media. I'm trying to get people to go to the website to buy something. So like I need to kind of give a little bit, but also I need to, you know, show what I'm doing. So it's very quick. We don't need to talk about me. One of the things, talking about cheesy and talking about problems is, I've been waiting. Last time you were on this episode, we were talking about the bacon, egg, and cheese. And yes. I said, I cannot wait until you do the proper bacon, egg, and cheese as a reel. And you did. And it was quite a kerfluffle. And I will say this without any questions, 50 years of eating bacon, egg, and cheese, your description and the way you did it was perfect. And I have reasoning, because some of your followers clearly don't have enough perspective.
You know, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I do. I appreciate it. And it's one of those, as a kid, I worked, you know, growing up in this area, I live in Dutchess County, but I have a lot of family in Westchester County. We spent as a kid, you spend a decent amount of time going to the city, but I would definitely not claim that I'm a city boy.
Right.
But yeah, I grew up in Dutchess County. I still currently live in Dutchess County. I've lived in many other places throughout the United States. But yeah, as a kid, you work in deli and pizza places. And, you know, I worked at a deli as a kid, pretty much right up until I went to culinary school. And, you know, I was the grill guy. I was the flat top guy. And I mean, we would make thousands of egg sandwiches, thousands and thousands and thousands of egg sandwiches. And that's how we made them. So it's just like, and the deli I worked at was in Putnam County. So, you know, some people that are listening are not going to know the area, but, you know, they're kind of neighboring counties. You're within sort of an hour radius, Westchester, Putnam, Dutchess.
Right.
So whether you live in one or the other, you spend time there. And that's just how we always made egg sandwiches. It was always to me like, you should walk into a deli, you go, hey, can I get a bacon, egg, and cheese? You go grab the coffee. And by the time you get the coffee and go to the register, the bacon, egg, and cheese should be at the register.
Right.
It's just that type, you walk in, you walk out, you're back in the car, and you're done. It's not this fussy thing, or it has to be this or that or whatever, you know, but so that's kind of where the knowledge of the video came from, is making, like, probably over the career I worked at the deli, probably more than tens of thousands of these egg sandwiches.
Now, the criticism, which is very mild, obviously, I mean, no one's throwing a brick through your window about describing a bacon, egg, and cheese. People don't realize that you did it exactly the way you'd get it in the tri-state area, exactly how you're saying. Now, one of the things about a bacon, egg, and cheese, people were saying, it's got to be two eggs. Oh, it's not enough cheese. It can't be American cheese. Oh, you got to use it on a bagel. This is all incorrect. And the thing is, even the cooking, everything you did was correct. And there's a number, we just need to break this down, only because it's driving me crazy that people are writing all this bullshit, this stuff. I got to keep a PG. You got a reputation to uphold. The idea of the hard roll, the Kaiser roll, was also, it had a little bit each when you got them. They weren't fresh all the time, so you had a little bit of life in them once you make the sandwich and you let them steam in the wrapper. You're kind of reinflating the roll a little bit. When you do the egg, you put it all on the sandwich and you wrap in the foil. The egg and the bacon steam everything a little bit, and it breathes a little bit of life into maybe your day-old Kaiser roll, right?
Yes. Yep. And in addition, like, the American cheese becomes this, like, plasticky glue,
right?
Because who knows what's in American cheese? Well, you know, we know, but it becomes this, like, glued together amalgamation of, like, this one thing.
And the other thing is now, when you were younger, how much was a bacon, egg, and cheese?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, because I was thinking, I've been thinking about this also. I mean, again, I'm 43, so we're talking a very long,
let's just say 10 years ago. Let's say 10 years ago, what was a bacon, egg, and cheese?
I mean, we're talking 10 years ago, maybe $3, maybe, for bacon, egg, and cheese.
I was talking to David, the guy who works here, and I was saying $3.50. Okay, $3.50 was a pretty decent size, and then you maybe, you get some places you could do a bacon, egg, and cheese, and a coffee for like four and a quarter, something like that.
Yeah.
The bacon, egg, and cheese is not meant to be anything, an expensive, extravagant thing. So what do? One egg. Now,
yeah, it's not a designer sandwich.
It's not a designer sandwich. It was meant to be something, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm not that embarrassed. As recently, I've been doing so much running for the marathon. Sometimes I get so goddamn hungry. I found a gas station that has like a warmer box. And they have bacon, egg, and cheeses for $4.50, which, you know, and it's like, It does the job exactly the way it's supposed to be. It's steamed a little bit. The egg is cooked hard. It's got the cheese. It's got enough crispy bacon, and it's for $4.50. It should have been, you know, when I was $3.50, it'd be perfect. But it is exactly what you're looking for, because the bacon, egg, and cheese isn't just about the sandwich. It's about the contrast in the textures. That's why a bagel doesn't work, because you're chewing too much. It's too much chewing and tearing. Squishes everything out. And God forbid you have an everything bagel and you're driving. I mean that's just like, I mean, it's like shrapnel everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, forget about it. But a bagel doesn't do well with a bacon, egg, and cheese, because you need that contrast between the soft roll after it's been steamed, the egg, the cheese, and then the crispy bacon gives you the crunch, which brings me to the next point. These Taylor egg and ham people, these Taylor pork pork roll people, they've lost their minds. That whole thing, I've tried it three times. It doesn't have the texture that helps give you contrast with the egg and the cheese.
Yeah, and it's I mean, it's Jersey, so it's like, do we even need to? It's Jersey.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, so I got a couple comments of it, like, oh, next you need to do the Taylor ham versus whatever the other ham, and I, you know, you don't respond. I didn't respond to but in my head immediately was like, who cares?
Yeah, you are so good at this. You are so good at this. Well, this is the reason why people don't order ham and eggs and cheese on a roll. The only people I know who ever did that was when the McDonald's did the McMuffin, and it was that puck of, you know, that puck of egg and then ham and cheese on an English muffin. And it was like, that's the only time I ever saw ham. So if ham's not popular, why the hell would pork roll or whatever the hell that stuff is be popular? You need the crispiness and the crispy bacon to counteract the egg and the cheese and the thing. I'm telling you did perfect. Now, all their little ketchups for children, and don't use the chipotle mayonnaise that stuff. Those are all add-on extras. When you go to a deli or a bodega or whatever, you ask for bacon, egg, and cheese, and they say salt, pepper, and you say salt, pepper, ketchup. That's your real choice. You can add salt and pepper. I go salt and pepper, no ketchup, just because I feel as though, for me, the ketchup throws in a monkey wrench into what I'm looking for. Like it puts me off a little bit, but at the same time, I'm not mad about it.
Yeah.
But the amount of people who said, you're not doing it right, and that looks skimpy, and then you should be more eggs, and this should be more. No. You're looking for something simple, easy, and effective. And the way you did it, I'm just telling you this, was terrific. And I loved how you're starting to take some shots, which I really appreciate. You need everybody needs a little bit of subversion, and you're starting to dip your toe in being slightly subversive at a PG level, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I have a couple here and there where you know, I'll get, whether it's a little comment or a little something, but it's just, obviously we're just making jokes.
Yeah.
Pretty much 99.9% of people understand that I'm just making jokes. But at the same time, you know, we're having fun. We talked a little bit about this last time, is that, like, you know, this whole thing has become a place where I get to make like what I want, when I want, how I want to. And I'm not ever going to like guard what I say or tiptoe around a certain subject or thing, because I think, ooh, maybe these 10 people aren't going to like this thing. It's just not going to happen.
You're not controversial though.
No, no, it's not controversial. And to me, the bacon, egg, and cheese video, I mean, to me, it's just a factual video.
Yes.
It's just what it is. So, and I will say the double egg thing, I can see. It was probably the most valid, I don't want to call it a complaint, but probably the most valid thing that made me think, that goes like, oh, maybe it's a regional thing. Like maybe there's some places in the city, and you will, like every once in a while, even around here, if you go around and get bacon, egg, and cheeses at different places, every once in a while, you'll stumble on the place that does the two egg by default.
Right, that's the generosity restaurant. That's a generosity place.
Yes, but then I started thinking like it may be more in the city, because I'm not in the city near every day. I'm not in the city hardly ever. But like, then it got me thinking about, with the rising cost of everything, if you're in the city and you do a double egg, bacon, egg, and cheese, you know, they're getting like $9 for bacon, egg, and cheese or whatever they're getting for it.
Probably, yeah.
So like, maybe is that the case where you're now charging whatever, $7 to $9 for bacon, egg, and cheese, and you put two eggs on it, so people aren't like, where the, to me, I feel like the days of the $3 or $4 bacon, egg, and cheese are gone.
gone unless you go to a gas station. I mean,
yeah.
There's certain. I'm shocked. This it's a shell right by me, and I was hungry, yeah. And I just was like, I grabbed it, and I was like, that is a $4 bacon, egg, and cheese right there. Definitely was fine.
Yeah, that's a great find, because I can even remember, when I was in high school, there were a couple of gas stations like Shell or Getty gas stations or wherever they were that would have like incredible bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches. You just kind of stumble upon them.
And if you did, and this is not the worst idea in the world either. I'm not telling you what to do. You know what you're doing. If you were to do like one of what everyone's doing, these high level, you know, bougie style, people would say they were bougie. Like that was, if you had like gone over the top and didn't, and you even said this is going to be a single egg. You know, you said this is going to be a single egg bacon, egg, and cheese. Everything you do is very like correct and you're very dialed in. If you were to do like a real high end one, people would be like, that's not what you get at a bodega. So people would still complain. The funny part is what you said in terms of controversy. The one thing you made a joke about the vegetarians, and I was a vegetarian for a long time, and I definitely know. I've gone, you know, when you go past a few years of being a vegetarian, the smell of meat and all that stuff can be brainwashed into thinking it smells disgusting. Like, I know where that comes from, but I never felt like, I was never one of these people, you invited me over for dinner and I said, I can't eat that, I'm vegetarian. I wasn't like that kind of person. I didn't tell everybody I was vegetarian. But like, yeah. I just decided for a while, like 3 years, decided to just give it a whirl and it was fine. And whatever. You made some crack about, you said, oh, you can't use bacon grease anymore. The vegetarians ruined everything. It was a very tongue-in-cheek, nothing to write home about. You know, once again, not a brick through the window controversy. And there was one comment saying, I'm not a vegetarian, but I thought that was really rude what you said about vegans and vegetarians. You just lost a follower. And all I could think of is, that's unbelievable. I mean, you got to be out of your mind. That is unbelievable. Why would you even waste the time and energy to write something like that? Who cares?
Well, I think people, they just want to let you know about certain things like that. And my own wife was a vegetarian for a very, very long time. And even currently, she'll pretty much only add like fish into her diet. But it's like 99.9% of all people kind of understand the joke, even vegetarians. And I will say 100% of people that have ever worked in the food industry, whether you're vegan, vegetarian or not, will understand the joke and the reference. Also, that is also another fact. It is factual that delis and places like that with flat tops will not cook their eggs in bacon fat anymore because of the people come vegetarians. They just want the potatoes off the flat top or whatever. They want their vegetarian melt or whatever sandwich. And they don't want to contaminate it with bacon fat.
That makes sense.
And it makes sense. But what's even worse, I mean, obviously, with some of these videos, you don't have time to go into all of this stuff. But, you know, you'll see like canola oils used, or even worse, you know, that yellow butter flavored like liquid stuff, whatever it is. So it's like, well, I mean, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it's another rabbit hole you could go down.
100%.
But, you know, it's fine. It's like vegetarians are sometimes a pain. I mean, that's fine. That's fine. And also correct.
You're right.
I love vegetarians. Yeah. If you're complaining, I mean, granted, I'm a freedom of speech absolutist. So you should be able to say whatever you want, whenever you want. And then obviously if there's consequences to what you're saying, then there's going to be consequences. But if you're the person that's complaining about the vegetarian comment on somebody's video, you're the person they're talking about.
You're absolutely right. My opinion is I don't fight for free, and I cannot put my time and energy into fighting someone on the internet. There's a guy who is like a deli owner. He's yelling at some guy who goes to delis, and they're going back and forth, and I'm just like, I don't have the time to launch my assault and then wait for another assault to come back to me so I can figure out what I'm going to say. I can't do that. I'm too fragile, frankly. And
yeah, and it's unnecessary space in your head. Like it occupies unnecessary space in it.
Completely unnecessary. I did want to play one thing for you. I sent it to you, and it was just because of the bacon conversation and people have such opinions about things. This is Chef Jose Andres, and he's talking about the fact that people don't understand what the hell they're doing when it comes to bacon. Let me just kind of get it up for you. But this is the one of the best chefs on the planet talking about people's
crispy bacon is the Darth Vader of bacon. Bacon was never supposed to be crispy, people. It was supposed to be used on the griddle, one side, the other, and eat it nice and fatty and warm. Crispy. Why crispy bacon?
Because we love the texture of crispy bacon.
This is Darth Vader.
We love the crunch.
99.9% of people don't know how to eat bacon.
This is American.
No. Crispy bacon. Here. Get out of here, people. Here.
That was him talking with Alice Waters and Thomas Keller about how he doesn't like the fact that people want their bacon crispy. It's hilarious.
Yeah. And although, like, I mean, obviously people get bacon however they want. I'm on team soft bacon. My own preference. I like a nice soft bacon. I will eat it crispy. But if I get my choice or if I cook it at home for myself, I like a nice soft bacon. I'm on that team.
Oh, look, you are. You're unbelievable. Well, all right, before we get to the questions, we got a lot of questions to get to, and I feel terrible that we've gone this long without starting the questions. What's your opinion on pineapple pizza? I'm only saying this because it's been dragged out of me for years now on Knife Talk and here and then on Overseasoned, and I don't think it's good, but I'm for people liking it. What's your opinion on pineapple pizza?
Of course, yeah. People can eat whatever they want, and I'm nobody to tell you shouldn't eat this and you shouldn't do this. I will say as a caveat, again, as a kid growing up working in pizza places all over the area where I live, you know, you do a lot of experimenting, and we did used to build a pineapple bacon red onion pizza that was a tasty pizza. That being said, I would never order pineapple on pizza. There's a million other different kinds of pizza.
It's not for me.
It's not for me. I'm not into it. And it's like, if I'm going to a pizza place that I'm a plain pizza kind of guy. Like I feel like the only slice you can judge a pizza place on is the plain slice.
That's the Dave Portnoy way.
Okay. I will allow like a white slice. If you have a good white slice, I like a nice white slice. But also that being said, is just because you have an excellent white slice does not translate that you will also have an excellent plain slice.
Oh, that's interesting to talk about.
But to me, I think both slices can have their place. Like if you go, oh, this place has an amazing white slice, but their regular slice is not as great. That's okay. I'll go and get a white slice.
Is this because they don't like the taste of the sauce?
It just depends. I mean, there can be a million different factors. You know, maybe the dough isn't done right. Maybe the sauce, like you said, maybe the sauce is a little bit off. I will say one of the things that a lot of pizza places do that I think is a detriment to them, I understand production-wise, but they will use the same size dough ball for a house pie, which is larger, than a pie that you order for takeout, which is smaller. So essentially on your takeout pizza, you're getting more dough and more crust than you would if you went in and you got a slice of their house pie, because they're using the same size dough ball. So the house pie, because it's a larger diameter, gets stretched thinner.
Whoa. I always knew that there was a difference between getting a slice at a slice shop compared to a full pie, because I do believe that almost that reheated slice is also kind of better a little bit, because you're pushing that cheese a little bit farther along on that kind of like that oily crispiness.
Yeah, you're eating it like straight off of that deck oven.
Yeah. Yeah. So you prefer a slice at a slice shop than a whole pie?
If I can. I mean, you know, great pizza is great pizza. But if we're getting really like down in the nitty gritty, I'll take a slice of a house pie, you know, from a really good pizza place.
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Now, with that said, we have a ton of questions.
Let's
we're going to try to get to as many as we can. We're going to have to obviously do another episode. But if you want to send questions in for Bob, obviously you can send them into Everyday's Feast Day and he'll send them to me. Or you can go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram and then you can send your questions for Bob. And that is what our friend, where are we going to go for first? Let's go with Paula Walla 533 sent you a message that says, can you use the green part of a garlic clove?
The green part of the garlic clove. I'm assuming that they're meaning this
the
is
top.
The, Like, I sent you the screenshots of all the pictures, but I purposely tried not to see any of them. So we're kind of getting off the cuff here.
Okay.
I'm assuming the person is meaning sometimes when you cut a garlic clove in half, there'll be that little sort of, sometimes it's green, but you can, it's a visible, I don't even know what the terminology is for the piece. And then sometimes as a garlic clove gets a little bit older, that piece will start to sort of sprout out of the top.
Right.
I always use it if I have it. I have worked at places where they have somebody that will remove it. The person who owned the place thought that it made the garlic bitter. I don't have that same experience. So I use the whole garlic clove. If it has that little sprout coming out, I mince it right along it. I use it right along with the garlic.
And do you cut the bottom end off that is attached to the bulb? Do you ever cut that little part off?
Most of the time I will. Most of the time I'll cut that off. But again, it's not, you know, it's one of those things I don't think it's necessary, but most of the time I will.
Okay. Yeah. Next comes from Roger 5580. Do you have any tips for introducing people to seafood, especially for picky eaters?
Okay. It would be a little helpful to know some foods that this person likes, like, or whoever you're trying to introduce with seafood, to kind of get a base of like maybe some of their favorite foods, what kind of foods they enjoy. Maybe if they like, they love Thai food or something. But I would say like cod is very approachable. It's sweet. If you cook it right, if you cook cod right and you sear it nicely in a pan, it almost gives off a scallop sort of flavor. It's sweet and oceany, but not fishy.
Right.
And it's also lighter. Like if you have ever eaten cod and then salmon in the industry is what we call more of like a fatty fish. It just has more fat content to it. So that's kind of intensifies the flavor a little bit. But cod is much lighter. Halibut is another one much lighter. It's a little bit more pricey. Scallops is kind of, everybody loves scallops, I feel like.
It's hard to not like a scallop. I mean, because it doesn't even have the same texture as fish. It's not flaky. It has a firmer texture, especially when, you know, that I think would be more pro. Who don't like fish generally like chicken. And you're getting the closest thing to chicken in terms of texture as a scallop.
Yeah, it's a much cleaner tasting fish, and it has a sweetness to it that I think appeals, you know, when you first taste it. Things that are sweet usually appeal more to people in general. And also, like, if a person enjoys a certain style of food, like, say, a Chinese takeout or a Thai food or an Italian food or something, where you can take, some shrimp or a piece of cod, and you can apply the flavor profiles from, you know, maybe that cuisine's culture that they enjoy to that piece of food. You know, you can make like a General Chow shrimp or a cashew, you know, like a cashew chicken treatment to a cod or something.
Have you ever been to City Island?
No.
City Island is a small, like, it's like an Italian island off of, kind of off the Bronx a little bit. It's like a seaside place. And they're famous for their you go down, it's a great place. At some point you got to go down there. And they have these fish places. And there's this one place that we go every year, every summer. It's called Johnny's Reef. And it's a cafeteria style place. The drive is great.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Right, you're going down the Hutch, and then next thing you know, you're almost like in like baby Italian Nantucket, or I don't know what you'd call it. And then next thing you know, you're down by the water, and then you go get a tray, and then you can order. There's a pile of different places. You can get raw clams. You can get fried anything. Like every shrimp, the fried squid. They got, you know, frog's legs if you want them. They have raw oysters. They got raw clams. They have fried lobster tail. Everything's fried. And people go there, and then they have these family events. You can sit on a picnic table. You get, they're very famous for, you get a frozen pina colada with a Henny floater. You know, have you ever had one of them? You have one of them. It's the craziest thing. A pina colada with a Henny floater. There's a little bit of Hennessy on top. And it's the wildest thing to pair with fried fish. But that's what they do. Everyone's got a pina colada and fried fish. And I tell you what, it's such a blast being by the sea and having all this wild, most likely it's half of it's frozen. But it's a kind of an event. And, you know, that's the way that you got to find something that kind of be a little bit adventurous. And it's one of those things I grew up never having fried. My dad never had, we never ate fried food. And it was one of those things that going to Johnny's Reef was always such a treat.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point that I didn't even think of, is that fried anything, you know, you get like fried clams, fried shrimp, fried stuff like that. Most people who maybe they tiptoe around seafood are going to find some sort of fried something that they enjoy. Stuff like that is one of my favorite ways to eat. I love eating, like picking and mixing and stuff like that. And then anytime you can incorporate outside, you know, the ambiance, you're smelling the city and you're most likely smelling the river, but it adds to the experience like that. I love doing stuff like that.
I love what you said about Thai food, because there's a lot of Thai dishes where they have fish and you have these very fragrant, you know, Thai aromas, and that you might not eat the fish that you normally would, but it's like the whole fish Thai. It's unbelievable. All right, we got to keep going. We got to keep going. Okay. Next comes from, we have a lot. You send me a lot. You have a lot of followers. They have a lot of questions.
We got a lot. Yeah, we got a lot. So I'm happy for that. But, you know, like you said, we'll get to what we can get and we go another time. And
my man, I'm with you. The next comes from G Balls Whiskey. I don't know. GBALZEWSKI. What are the best peppers with the least amount of heat?
Okay. To me, off the top of my head, I would probably say a poblano. They can have a tiny bit of heat, but it's nothing, you know, that even somebody who's sensitive to spicy food, you know, you wouldn't be too sensitive to it, but it has a nice chili flavor. And you can get dried poblano peppers are called ancho chilies. So they have basically a similar heat level, but it might be a little bit more concentrated because dry stuff is a little bit more concentrated, but again, nothing unmanageable, but a very nice, like leathery, raisiny sort of, chili flavor. So you can have the mix with the fresh and the dried ancho chilies, and it's a great pepper to use for all different types of stuff.
One thing that Jacques Pepin does is when he's cooking, he cooks with a lot of jalapenos, as he tells you, because jalapenos, he says it the same way. He's the best. I mean, he's legitimately, it's like the grandfather you always wanted, you know?
And yeah, he just turned 90, I think.
Yeah, he just turned 90. And he says, when you're doing, and he says it with this thick French accent, which is fantastic. And he goes, he always says, you got to try the jalapeno because it could be a bell pepper, or he always says, or it could blow your mind. I love it when he says it. It's always so funny because it's like,
it's a good way to put it. Yes.
He says, because either it tastes like just like a green pepper or it'll blow your mind, which I love. This one comes from Nico 0424. Do you have any advice for someone who wants to be a chef? That's a big one.
Yeah, it is. It's a topic that could be, I mean, we could do a whole episode on that one. I would say it's kind of like figuring out what you want to do when you're in high school. I would say to maybe think of some sort of direction you might want to go, or you think it could take you. Meaning that, do you think you want to, at the time being, do you think you want to work in a restaurant forever? Would you like to work in hotels? Would you like to work at a college or things like that? That sort of can decide if you should at minimum look into getting a certificate program. There's a million great ones. You go through a certificate program and at the end, you know, it's not a full degree, but you get a certificate on finishing the program. That piece of paper can serve you very well as you try to climb ladders, especially corporate ladders, whether it be hotels, colleges, food service companies I worked for Bon Appetit Management Company for a long time, but they're owned by Compass. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Right. Compass
food,
Media, right.
Food service companies. Yes. Whereas if you want to work in a restaurant or the restaurant business appeals to you, I would say go to the busiest restaurants where you live and ask for a job. They may say no. And you can go back as many times as you want. Many places will actually, you know, honor the fact that you were a pain at nagging them and nagging them and nagging them to get you in the door. It may be mopping floors. It may be washing dishes. It may be doing whatever. But the point is that you're showing up, and make it known that, make it known what you want. You know, if you can get in the door in one of these places, even if it's washing dishes, watch what's going on in your downtime. Always make sure you're cleaning. Even if your station is the dish pit, your station is in good order. It's tidy. It's clean. You're always ready. The chef needs something. You're always available to do that something, whatever it is. I need you to grab me a onion out of the walk-in. You run and you, whatever. And make it known. Like, I want to learn how to pick herbs. I want to learn. And it can be, depending on the restaurant, it can be in baby steps. Obviously, if it's a very fine dining restaurant, it's going to be baby steps. They'll probably won't even let you peel potatoes. You know, you might pick parsley for 6 months, and that just could be your situation. But show up every day, listen, do what you're told, make yourself available to learn everything that you want. And also, one thing that I try to teach young cooks is to learn when you need to make decisions, like learn to recognize that moment when you need to make decisions. Meaning, like, if you're not learning at a place or you're not happy where you are, make the decision to leave immediately. In 6 months. And I can talk a big game. Everybody has their financial needs, and that's completely understandable. But even knowing when that moment happens for you, where you go, oh, this place is not teaching me what I want to be learning. I need to find another place. That could mean leaving the place. It could mean spending your days off finding a new place.
Wouldn't you also say that restaurants are more eager to hire someone with less experience, that they can train them how to do things their way, as opposed to somebody who's come from culinary school and I know how to do it like this, and it's not the way that the restaurant wants it done?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And your work ethic and your willingness to, like, show up, you know, be kind, be nice, listen, do what you're told, you'll outpace anyone who went to culinary school that does not have the same values easily.
There you go. Look at that. We did it. We did it. Now keep going. I mean, I didn't mean to sound like we did it. The episode's over. We got a lot of movement to do.
Judy, it's one of those topics we could go on about. But yeah, let's.
Well, yeah. Well, we could have gone on about the difference between a chef and a cook, but I think that we can save that for another time.
Yes.
A lot of
people
say they want to be a chef, but chef is also being like the general, as opposed to some people want to cook.
Yeah, you're managing people, and in many places, you're managing people far more than you're physically cooking.
All right, next, this one comes from Facebook. Let's go with Susie. Susie Welker says, would love to know more about all the different salts available. Do you use a lot of different types of salt?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there are a lot of different salts. That's one that's, because I myself, and in all professional food industry, kosher salt is the standard salt.
Right.
From producing, it's just a coarser, very minimally processed, uniform tasting salt. I have learned from making content that in other countries they do not call it kosher salt.
I'm sure.
Some places call it rock salt. Some places just call it sea salt. But, like, to me, rock salt is the stuff you put in, like, a water salt.
Yeah, on your driveway in the winter.
Yeah, on your driveway in the wintertime. So kosher salt, if you're not using kosher salt, you get some kosher salt, start playing and experimenting with kosher salt. I always try to teach people to season with a pinch and not out of a salt shaker. So kosher salt will allow you to do that. And you can really start feeling how you're using salt, if that sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
But then kosher salt is a great all-use salt. You can season meat with it. You can make soup with it. You can finish dishes with it. Where there are salts, say, like Maldon or Himalayan pink salt and other salts like that, where I would use more like a finishing salt. Or, like, you know, you make a salad and put some Maldon is like a coarser, almost crispy salt. But it's big, it's bigger flakes. It's a flaky, but it has a crispy texture to it specifically, I would say. But, like, you know, you put a little Maldon in a salad and the salad pops. Or you finish a braised short rib with it. And you're not wasting the salt in the beginning of the braise. You're using kosher salt. But then as a finishing, you plate it, you put a little Maldon on top, and you get these pops of crispy salt with that soft and fatty meat.
Would you bake with kosher salt?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I bake with kosher salt all the time.
Okay.
But you bring up a good point, too. Some, you know, some you'll see Maldon sometimes on top of cookies or maybe finish on a bread and then it goes into the oven, and that's perfectly acceptable. But I mean, I worked at a place we used to, for our bread and butter, you know, that every table got, we would serve it would be like a salt tasting where we would have like 12 different kinds of salt that came with your bread and butter. So you kind of do a little sampling. But I mean, there's black salt and gray salt and Himalayan pink salt and Maldon. I'm forgetting a million salts. But I would say kosher is a great starting point. And then if you really want to sort of get something to kind of fancy your salt playfulness, I guess, Maldon is a great one to grab and add to play with. I really think people could play with salts. I think that's the right terminology.
I grew up in a household. My father, well, doesn't matter. But when we used to have the cylinder jar of the Morton's salt, the iodized salt with the girl with the, what was the girl with the, is it, that was it, was the girl with the umbrella and then somebody's pulling her shorts down or something like that? Or that's maybe it's that's something else. Something
you might be
like
you might be crossing, I think, Paint and Morton's.
Yeah, I think I'm crossing a few things out. But yeah. I remember always when we, if you oversalted something, it was because you're using that super thin iodized salt. And then my dad, who was a really great chef, used to start to, you know, push us into using kosher salt, and then it made everything just kind of like, I felt like we weren't oversalting things as much when we were using kosher salt.
Yeah, and when you're seasoning, especially salt, with a pinch, and if you're doing that practice every time you cook, you will learn what your pinch tastes like. So it will make you much more consistent with salt.
There you go. Learning what your pinch tastes like. I'm with you. Now, if this wasn't you, if this was one of my goofball friends, that would be the name of this episode. That's you know what a pinch tastes like.
Learn what your pinch tastes like. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Next thing is from Judy Olson. Judy Olson wants to know. Judy Olson found us on Facebook, sent you a message on Facebook. How to cook a pork chop that's juicy and not dry. Now, growing up, we definitely had pork chops very rarely. And the reason why is because the ones we would get from the supermarket were on the thin side. And there was this giant fear of trichinosis for some reason. And there was never, you never had pork with a little bit of pink in it. And I feel as though that might be part of it.
Definitely. I will say, like, it does, it's not completely gone. But trichinosis in U.S., at least, not U.S. specifically, but domestic pork, meaning not wild pigs, because feeding practices and sort of butchering and care practices have changed to the point where trichinosis is not really a concern anymore. I think people have this, to me, and you've seen it done, we've all seen it done, whether it's your mother or somebody takes raw pork chops, puts them on a tray, sticks them into an oven, and like the oven could not even be preheated yet, possibly. They just stick it in there. And I mean, it's just going to be not good. I mean, you're going to have a fear, not fear, but you know.
You have a tough chop.
Yes. Tough and dry and just not what you want. And I actually have a specific video on pork chops that sometimes I'll direct people to because it is a common question you get. But to me, the best way to, I would buy, if you can, buy a section of boneless pork loin, and you can cut your own pork chops out of that. You're basically slicing thick steaks out of a boneless pork loin. That is a pork chop. Because now you can control the thickness of your pork chop. It gives you a much larger room to be able to like not dry it out. So then you would sear both sides in a high, you know, medium high pan, season it with salt and pepper, however you want to season it, sear it, finish it in an oven, and 100%, if you're not familiar or comfortable with cooking meats, is buy a meat thermometer and use a meat thermometer. It will change your life forever, a meat thermometer. Get a meat thermometer. I cannot, like, I feel like I'm going to tattoo it on my forehead. Meat thermometer.
Don't do that.
Yeah, I won't.
Know, I don't think
my wife would have something to say.
I don't think I needed to say that, but, you know, this day and age, you never know. I saw a guy got a tattoo of a Mets logo under his eyeball. I'm just like, hey, bro.
What can you have?
Yeah.
I'll put on a t-shirt.
Come on.
I'll put on a t-shirt.
Yeah, put on a t-shirt. Put on a t-shirt.
Yeah. But you can learn the temperatures of what you're after, whether it's medium rare, medium. I love pork chops medium rare to medium. I have no problem eating them pink or even the same temperature as you would a medium rare steak. I have no issue with it. I've never had any problems with it. I've never heard of anyone having any problems with it. And also, you know, you sear a pan, finish it in the oven to the temperature that you want. I would say probably 5 to 8 degrees if you can, under the temperature you want it to finish at. And the second most important thing besides a meat thermometer, arguably, is to let it rest. Meat thermometer and resting are arguably the most important parts, but let it rest for at least 5 minutes before you kind of cut into it, serve it, do whatever you're going to do with it. And you're going to have a nice, you're going to have a juicy pork chop.
Years ago, a friend of mine who was a chef when I was working for the Charlie Palmer Group, guy said to me, I only eat chicken medium rare. And I was like, that's a crazy thing to say. Mm-hmm. And then I started to kind of hang out with these guys, and they were cooking a chicken breast, not a chicken thigh, chicken breast, just to the point where it was just barely pink, or even a little bit pink. Just not when you cut into it, it wasn't opaque. You know what I mean? It was like, it wasn't just like that glossy rawness, but it was just a little bit of pinkness, and they would let it rest. And then you're just slightly sailing into this doneness that when you cut into it, you get the slightest hue of pink, but the chicken breast is so juicy and moist, it doesn't taste like the dried chicken that you're used to.
Yes. And to me, like cooking a chicken breast like that, I mean, obviously they weren't going after a specific number that you know of or anything like that. But cooking a chicken breast like that is one of the bigger flexes of cooking. It's delicious, and it's one of those things that, like, you nail a chicken breast, and like, how many people can nail a chicken breast like that? There's not a lot.
It is shocking how a perfectly cooked chicken breast will kind of not change your life, but it will change your opinion on chicken breast, because generally people don't like chicken breast because there's not a lot of flavor and everything like that. But if you get it well seasoned on the outside, and then you cook it to a point where it's barely on the money, it's like the most luxurious thing you had. You're shocked that it's chicken breast.
Yeah, and that's also one of the big appeals of sous vide, the sous vide cooking method.
Right,
is that you can get chicken, you can nail it at that temperature that you want, because that water bath will never go above the temperature you set it at. So like, that's one of the things people will. You know, now they're readily available. I mean, you can buy the machines to do it on Amazon now for, you know, 20, 30, 40 bucks. They're super accessible, and people will do a chicken breast sous vide and then sear in a pan, and it does indeed change their life. They go, and then now they're swearing by sous vide. It's because they were able to nail that temperature.
I like it when I see videos of people with the sous vide machine in just like a Home Depot bucket. They fill the Home Depot bucket full of water, and then there's chicken in there, and they got the sous vide rod in there, and it's slightly hilarious. It's like
I love
the hardware store to cook dinner.
Yeah, and the first sous vide immersion circulator I ever had, I built from Home Depot parts. Like, this is back when you know, the French Laundry had a immersion circulator, and they were like $7,000 to get, you know, to get the cheapest one was like $7,000 to get a tabletop one. We went to Home Depot and bought a bunch of parts and figured out how to make, with a plug-in thermostat, how to make our own immersion circulator.
You're looking at you're a maker.
I used that thing for years and years and years. And plus, you could use it. I mean, we did an event. It's funny. Like, we did an event where I did like 70 pounds of ribs in my bathtub. Because it was a heating element with a thermostat. So you could do, we used to sous vide stuff in coolers, bathtubs, any body of water, because it would hold it at that temperature.
That's like that Seinfeld where Kramer's taking a shower and cleaning his lettuce.
Oh yeah,
you ever see that episode? He decides he put a disposal system in the drain, and so he's washing the lettuce and the salad and taking a shower at the same time. It's very funny.
And also to keep in mind, like, when I say event, it was like for a large group of friends. We weren't doing this. And I at the time I lived in an apartment. I had a cast iron bathtub, so we were doing it in the cast iron bathtub, and it worked great.
No one's calling the health department on you, Bob. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why people like chicken thighs as much as they do? Because they're kind of indestructible. You know, maybe it's a little bit easier for the home cook to cook chicken thighs. And I know you do such a great job making things approachable, and you use chicken thighs a lot. Do you think that that's the reason why people like chicken thighs so much?
Yeah, I mean, it has, like you talked about, that when you hit the exact temperature on a chicken breast, the experience that you have with that chicken breast, that window is much larger on a chicken thigh.
Huge.
So it's much easier to hit that temperature on a chicken thigh than it is on a chicken breast. Granted, they're two different muscles and the texture and is different, but the experience of eating it where you're almost transforming your mindset is similar.
You got to take a nap to overcook a chicken thigh.
Yes.
I mean, you got to go away for a while to ruin a chicken thigh. It is hard to ruin a chicken thigh.
Yeah, something has to go wrong, yeah.
Something really bad, like something to get knocked out or something. All right, yeah. Next one comes from, they'll keep on the same path, Anne Elizabeth Phelps Schrock. Anne Elizabeth Phelps Schrock asks, how do you cook steaks?
I like steaks pretty much medium rare for myself. I don't mind them rare, but to me, like, I like burgers rare, steaks, I typically like more medium rare, but it's really just sort of a textural thing. Once you get into medium rare, some of the chewiness kind of comes out of like even a ribeye or a New York strip or something like that. I'll eat it rare. I enjoy it rare, but it's definitely a little bit more chew to it. Then once you start getting into that medium rare texture range, it becomes sort of like more of that buttery texture that everybody loves.
There was, to get into that, I did, during the pandemic, I was doing some live videos with Chef Charlie Palmer, and we were cooking together on live, and it was very funny. And he wanted me to come up with an idea, and I said, well, I read about the black and blue steak. The black and blue steak came from the steel yards in Pittsburgh. They call it a Pittsburgh steak, or usually black and blue. And what they would do is, because there's so much steel going on, and they had to feed these guys, they were taking the steaks and just slapping them against the sides of the forges or the kilns, and they were cooking them very quickly. And then, because that's where it began. They would make these black and blue steaks to feed all these guys, and they were just, you know, cooking it really fast and really rare. When I was a kid, my grandfather and my mother's side and my mother, they liked steak super rare, like really rare, like black and blue is preferred. And then so I grew up that we had it black and blue. And then when I went to culinary school, my chef said to me, he's like, yeah, rare's great, but you won't ever really taste the complexities of the steak unless you go medium rare.
Yeah. I think there's just certain things that happen as far as like sort of the breakdown of the tissue and the fats and the, once you start to get close to that medium rare temperature.
What's your steak of choice? Give me your top three steaks of choice.
Oh, this is a good one. I have a video idea coming for this one too, but,
ooh, baby.
Well, we'll differ a little bit because there's a couple that won't make it on there. Okay. But I think top of the food chain for me is a ribeye. It sounds sort of normal, but I would go ribeye, New York strip, maybe a good New York strip and a good skirt steak sort of fall in that same line for me. And then I might go flat iron.
Nice.
I might go flat iron.
Deep
steak,
cut.
Right? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I might go flat iron.
My dad was incredibly cheap. And growing up in the 70s and 80s, like a lot of parents we ate so much, way more beef than I never even imagined. Like now we didn't eat, back when I was a kid, we were eating beef once a week at least. I mean, or steak once a week at least. He was a huge fan of the London broil. And because it's a cheaper cut, the London broil isn't an actual steak. It's a way of cooking a tougher cut where you're cooking it either very rare or you're cutting it on a bias to kind of against the grain to create something a little bit easier to chew, and you cut it really thin and all that. So growing up, we ate skirt steak all the time because it was very inexpensive, and it was like, to me, I feel like the skirt steak is one of the greatest steaks because you get the true beefy flavor, and it is very, when you cook it, it can be very tender based on how you cut it. But the crazy part is everyone's figured that out now. And or my dad used to call them a chain steak or a skirt steak. Now it's so expensive to get like even a mediocre skirt steak. It's shocking.
Yeah. And because I lump hanger steak also with the skirt steak, steaks, but very, very, very similar. But yeah, they catch on like a lot of things like that, like short ribs and even chuck steak. I've noticed I tend to buy a lot of chuck steak, just because you can treat it like a steak and grill it and slice it. And, you know, it's delicious. It has chuck steak. Is a little ribeye in there, But even that's sort of catching on, and like the secrets are getting out, and you know, they're everything's getting more expensive anyway. But like you said, skirt steak is a big one, and skirt steak is great because it also, as long as you slice it correctly, you mentioned the tenderness, but it works great on like sandwiches or tacos, because when you bite it, it's tender enough, if as long as you cut it the correct way, it's tender enough to where it pulls apart and you don't pull a whole piece of steak off of a sandwich.
I feel like the London broil needs a comeback.
I could see it making a comeback. I could see it. We ate it a lot as kids too.
Yeah, because it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's really easy to prepare. They usually taste terrific. You don't really realize that you're eating. You know, you go to like a party or like a catering event, people will have, you know, London broil. All right, there you go. I would never tell you what to do, but yeah.
No.
London broil, man. You know, maybe it'd be interesting. You know, these people, everyone. You, one of the things you do is you make approachable foods. You know, you never know.
Yeah, we're gonna bring back the hype for London broil.
Oh,
even the word reminds me of my childhood. London broil.
I know. It's the summertime. Yeah. You mean a London broil that you did your parents marinated in soy sauce. They, in a plastic bag, they jam it on the grill for 5 minutes. They cut it, and somebody says, "You're not cutting it thin enough. It's going to be too tough. You got to cutting it thin enough." And then, you know, and then you have a pile of it, and then you.
Yeah, or the wishbone Italian. Put the wishbone Italian
in
there.
Oh, baby. You got me. My dad used to marinate London broils, and he never treated a skirt steak as a London broil, like salt and pepper for London broils. But it was like those big shoulders and stuff. The London broil. They called it London. They used to call it a London broil. They don't call it anymore if you go to the supermarket. And then he would dump a bottle of Italian dressing. He would marinate it in Italian dressing, and then that was all you needed.
Yeah,
Ken's.
Yeah.
He liked Ken's Italian dressing. Ken's,
okay. Yeah.
You know, Ken's salad dressing.
Yep.
Let's go with. This one comes from Bobby Draper. Bobby Draper says, "Best way to clean your palate, and what? Best way to clean your palate. You know, what's your best way to clean your palate, and what's your go-to dish at home? Love the content, Bobby Draper. Bobby. Ooh,
okay. Yeah. Another one. Another Bob. It depends. I would say, like, if I'm in the kitchen tasting food, like I'm cooking and tasting as I'm working, probably just a couple sips of water, clear the. If I'm really focusing on like cleansing my palate, so I can take. Sometimes when I cook at home, I might have a beer or a glass of wine or what. You know, you're just kind of enjoying the time. But if it's in a coursed out meal, like if I am eating or if I have planned a coursed out meal to cleanse someone's palate, usually. You can include little bites of things in there to sort of clean someone's palate off. Typically, it might be a little bit acidic, or sometimes you'll see things like a savory sorbet, like a balsamic sorbet, or some sort of refreshing like lemon ice, or things like that. Acid, both vinegars and citrus acid, tend to sort of like break down fats and dissolve fats a little bit better. A lot of flavor is transferred through fat. I mean, flavors are transferred different ways, but fat tends to linger on your palate, on your tongue, inside of your mouth. So a lot of flavors that the fat will carry will sort of coat the inside of your mouth. So that's what you're sort of trying to break down and get rid of to kind of get you ready for a next course. Huh. So you might get maybe a lemony thing, or it could be a drink. It could be a, you know, you get like a lemon cocktail, or it could be, like I said, like sort of a lemon ice, a sorbet of sorts. I know a lot of like Michelin star restaurants or high-end restaurants, passion fruit is very common to see. You'll see passion fruit a lot. I don't want to say a lot, but it's pretty common to see in those arenas. But things along those flavor profiles can sort of be a breakup course in between courses to sort of get you ready. And also, that being said, I'm thinking out loud, like if you are building a menu, say you're having guests over and you're really at that level, you're like, I want to impress my guests or whatever. You want to impress your wife with dinner and you're going to plan a coursed out meal, is to plan the courses as they escalate in flavor. Like for an extreme, you would put, say, like a lighter fish dish before you would put braised short ribs. You would have braised short ribs after the fish because if you eat braised short ribs, you know, they're going to have some sort of a heavier sauce and a reduction in that fatty meat. And then you eat fish afterwards, you're not going to taste anything in the fish.
Right. I'm a big fan of seltzer water. I call it the.
I love it. Yeah, I love it.
I call it white noise. I don't want any flavors. I want straight white noise. Next is what. So Bobby also wants to know what is your go to dish at home.
Oh, go to dish at home. I eat a lot of, like, especially this time of year. I mean, I grill all year round anyway. I have a little cover out back of my house. I have the grill under the cover, so it's snowing or whatever. But I tend to grill a lot of, like, meats. And just for my own schedule, I do a lot of, like, where I'll say, like, grill a couple meats for the week, maybe, or for a few days. And then I'll probably, usually when it comes time for dinner or whatever, I'll just take, it might be a burger patty. It might be a piece of chicken. It might be, like, it might be a piece of skirt steak or something. And then I might make, like, a little salad on the side, or grill some vegetables, or roast some vegetables or something like that. But I typically will do that for the week. And then this way I do really well when I already know what I'm going to eat. I know it's not exciting and boring, and probably looking for a go-to meal is like some sort of culinary adventure. But most cooks, like when they're cooking at home, they're eating leftovers or,
yeah.
It's that kind of thing. So I sort of set myself up for success, I guess, in sort of that meal prep.
What do your kids love when you cook? What's their favorite dish you make?
My son is on the autism spectrum. So if people that are listening, you know, so he likes like probably five things. Actually one thing that he does love that I make is French toast, just simple homemade French toast. Nothing crazy, pretty much like how your mom did it. He has a bread that he likes for like grilled cheese and things like that. So I'm just using like your standard sort of potato bread. And then the eggs, the milk, the cinnamon, vanilla, basic, what's it called? Maple syrup at the end, basic French toast. He'll go wild for the French toast. My daughter has sort of come to love, pupusas, I would say, obviously. Wow. is one of her like kind of off the radar favorites. We make them together and then we'll eat them we eat them together. And it's just something that she likes a lot. It's one of the things like that. It'll make a great video, I think. But it's also one of those things for your kids. It's fun to do. It's sort of an arts and crafts project. They're very easy to make. They're very easy to make the filling in different kinds. And they freeze really well. So you can set yourself up. You get your kids involved. You make a whole bunch. And you can freeze them in the freezer. And then you can actually cook them from frozen. See, yeah.
I was going to say that it's a very loving thing. You know, cooking is about nurturing. And being able to kind of make the food that your children like is a very loving, nurturing opportunity that I don't think people realize how important it is. Not important, but how generous it is. And what the children see your parents or somebody is cooking for you. It's this very, very, it's a very, very unspoken love that carries with kids forever. It is a very loving thing to be able to identify what your kids love and then enjoy making it for them.
Oh yeah. I mean, I agree 110%. I mean, it's not only the skill set of sort of being able to make some of your own food as a kid, that, you know, obviously kids don't remember everything that you do with them or even say, you know, whatever, but it's the experiences that they remember over those things. Plus, cooking is a skill set. Where, you know, you make something once with your kid, whatever, it's a fun thing. But if it's something that your kid like goes after, like these pupusas, my daughter, she likes them. So every so often she'll ask for them again. So we'll make them again. Plus they freeze really well, like I said. So it's a great, like they're in the freezer. So one night of the week, you pop them out, cook them from frozen. Plus you're teaching them these skill sets and sort of like, there's this curiosity that happens. Maybe you're cracking eggs. Maybe you're kneading a dough with your bare hands, and it like sticks to your fingers and sticks to your elbow. And there's this, and it's almost like there's this part of it that's like caveman-esque, where you're in the moment, and it's like we've been doing this for tens of thousands of years. Like, you know, there's that feel to it. It's kind of like when you're in the woods, where there's this like natural feel to it. It's hard to explain, but if you know, you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. No, 100%. Yeah. No, that's fantastic.
It's like building a fire or something. Yeah.
Top fan, Paul Sabage. Top fan. He's a top fan. He got a diamond on it next to him. Top fan says, any good best burger recipes? And then he asked for a vegan burger, but I mean, let's just take one. a good burger recipe and a vegan burger recipe, that's two different things. You have any good burger recipes? How do you make your burgers?
I like a rare burger. I buy like the best quality ground. If I'm putting all the effort into it, I'll buy like the best quality ground beef that I can get my hands on. But I don't shy away from like, you know, your standard 80-20. I would say for me, 80-20 for say you're going to grill a burger is my favorite. Will I eat 85-15 or 90-10? Of course. But if I'm real, say we're going, I'll go 80-20. Sometimes if it's like a flat top burger or like a pan burger, I might even try maybe like 75-25 or even like a 70-30, like a fattier content. But standard 80-20, grill the burger. I like a medium rare burger. Cheese, for me, it just kind of depends on the mood. Maybe I'm in an American cheese place. Maybe I'm in a cheddar cheese place. It just really depends. And then for me, what really sets burgers apart are the condiments that you use for a burger. So like, and again, like no one's going to go full, you know, soup to nuts on here, but the more homemade condiments you can get, or the more homemade condiments you can keep in your house and keep in your refrigerator, you're going to find yourself using those homemade condiments in things. And then burgers ring especially true. You know, you have homemade pickles. You might have, you know, you can turn it into a relish. You can have sliced pickles. You might, my favorite, I just did a video on it recently, but like that New York style onion sauce,
I'll put on a burger. Some bread onion sauce. Yeah.
I'll eat that stuff off of a plate. But that on a burger, some cheese, a little lettuce, tomato, probably maybe an addition of like a little raw onion. And you, to me, like you just can't, you know, toast the bun maybe a little bit. A good bun where it's not too much bread for the burger, but also not too much burger for the bread also. So like that happy balance, and it's just kind of simplicity, and you know, you just can't go wrong with stuff like that. I feel like
burgers are unbelievably great. We eat, my wife doesn't like beef and pork, so we do turkey burgers.
Okay. Yeah.
We had at our old restaurant, Alva, the old chef used to, he used to sell it as turkey burgers, but he was using chicken. And he even went to a doctor to see if there are any allergies or anything like that. And people said we had the best turkey burger on the menu, and it's because the chef lied and just used ground chicken. And I started using ground chicken instead of a turkey burger, and it is for sure juicier, as long as you don't get the breast. You got to get the regular stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the one thing about the turkey burger, chicken burger thing, is the leaner stuff is the drier stuff. Like, I'm always shocked. Sometimes my wife does the groceries and she gets some ground chicken. It's all breast. And when you try to make a burger out of it, it is dry and awful, no matter how you cook it. So yeah. We're a huge turkey burger fans. And do not underestimate the power of ground chicken for a burger.
Oh, absolutely not. And I'll even go, like, for a turkey burger or chicken burger for that matter, I've always found like good caramelized onions can add sort of that fatty texture. I mean, obviously they're not fat, but they have sort of a jammy kind of texture to them.
Yeah.
And then things like avocado or guacamole, I love on a turkey burger or chicken burger. You're adding fat, but it's up in the form of avocados, which you're not like, you know, it's still good for you and stuff. And I will say like kind of my not standard, one of my favorite cheeseburgers that's not standard is cheddar cheese and kimchi on a burger.
Whoa.
Yeah, standard ground beef cheeseburger, melted cheddar cheese, kimchi on there.
Dang, that sounds good.
It just works. Yeah, it's just fantastic. It's just great, yeah.
We have one last question, then I'm going to make a plea. I'm going to make a plea. This one comes from our man, Douglas Ruff. Doug Ruff, I am with you. What's an easy carbonara recipe, please? Easy carbonara recipe.
Okay.
Bacon, egg, and cheese, or pasta. We're wrapping it all up.
I know, and I actually have a video on this. People yelled at me because I used bacon instead of guanciale, which is the correct pork jowl, which is the correct meat. But sometimes you can't get the pork jowl or whatever, you use bacon.
Of course.
And it's another one of those things that like, we'll get it. But it's one of those recipes that like for every grandmother, there's a different recipe for carbonara. There are certain rules to making carbonara, but it's another one of those dishes that comes from times of necessity where you don't have any money, you have minimal scraps of food, and you need to feed like workers and children and, you know, family and these things. It comes from like a time, that sort of time. So either way, whether you're going to use pancetta, guanciale, or just bacon, is for me, you render the bacon. You can use as much of the bacon fat as you want or none. To me, it doesn't matter. Some people swear you have to use the fat. You don't have, whatever. You can use little, as much of the bacon fat as you want. You render the bacon. You cook the pasta. Let's see, I want to make sure I don't miss any ingredients so I don't get like roasted for this also.
They don't listen to this. Don't worry about that.
So as your pasta is cooking in the water, you want to scramble eggs, raw eggs. And for me, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I think for a half a pound of pasta, I will do one whole egg and two egg yolks. So I'll do two egg yolks, one whole egg for every half pound of pasta, right?
Right.
So we render the meat, we cook the pasta, mix the egg, put a handful of Parmesan cheese into the mixed raw egg.
In a cold bowl.
Yeah, in a cold bowl. You're not cooking any. You're not cooking the egg at all.
You're not cooking the eggs, right?
No. Do not cook the egg. Set it on the counter. Eggs, don't put it near the heat. Yes.
Raw eggs scrambled with cheese in a cold bowl. Okay.
Yes. You want to leave your bacon or pork product and as much fat as you want in the pan. You want to pull the pasta out of the pan in whatever water drips is fine. Pull the pasta out of the pan, out of the pot that's boiling, into the pan. Don't get rid of the pasta water. You might even want to save some in a cup or just leave the pot of water right there. So you put the pasta into the pork, whatever your pork product is. Then you add your mixed raw egg. Right now you have no heat. Heat is off. You want to work quick so the pasta stays hot, but the heat on the pan is off. Pasta into the pan. Raw egg and the Parmesan cheese into the pan. Then you're going to start to mix with the warm pasta. The raw egg, the pork, the Parmesan cheese, mix, mix, mix. Then you can add more pasta water to create you want it like velvety, and you don't want it dry and gloppy. You want it velvety and like nice and, velvety, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So you add enough pasta water so you bring this consistency to a nice velvety, but still clinging to the pasta. Then you can serve it as is. You can add it as much black pepper as you want. You can season it with salt, however salted you want. I like to cook the pasta in salted water. With dishes like this, I won't use a ton of salt because you're going to use that pasta water. That's the method. If we're talking just method, that is the method. Is that followable? Did I go like...
Super duper followable. And Guys, you can go to Everyday Feast Day where he has it in video form. I always thought it was the bacon, egg, and cheese of pasta, which I think was a nice kind of full circle moment for the two of us on this episode. What do you think?
You're correct. I took Italian in high school. I don't remember it. You know, for argument's sake, I don't remember any of it. But I remember my teacher used to always say that there's a pasta dish that is a bacon, egg, and cheese.
There you go. Look at you. All right. Now, here's the plea. I didn't expect to do this. We barely cracked the surface.
Surface. I feel like we both can just talk.
We barely cracked the surface. And I'm going to do something I've never asked before. Would you consider coming back next week for a part two?
Next Monday I am not available.
Okay. All right. Then we'll get you. We're going to get you back sooner rather than later to a part two.
We could talk
about the details later. If you were around on a Tuesday, you know, you're busy on Tuesday. No, you're busy. And we'll work it out. We're going to do a part two.
Well, I know. Well, and I had to change my, you know, you change your schedule for the kids and everything else. So it's like, you know, I got to make time for the people.
I'm with you. Look at you.
But we will 100% do it. And they're all good things. Like everything that's going on these Mondays that I am not available on are all things that are happening because of like the amazing followers and the people that are asking questions and all of this, like, curiosity and attention and all these people that are paying attention to what I'm doing. They're all things that I have to do because of that. So, I mean, to say I am appreciative does not even scratch the surface. I could never, even where I'm at now, I have no plans of stopping. If anything, I'm just going. So it's like, I can't thank these people enough. It's like, you know, it's wild to me that this is all going on.
Look at you. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I think it's great. I think everything you're doing is great. We're going to have you on. We're going to keep the ball rolling. We'll figure out the timing, framing, and everything. We'll get you back. I knew I threw that at you at the last minute, and you know that's how I do sometimes.
Hey, you know, if I was available, I love it. I love coming on here. We can do a million episodes as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, you heard it.
We'll do it. It's coming. It's coming. It's coming. It's coming.
All right. Now, guys, listen. Go follow every day. Feast Day on all platforms. I'm going to link it in the show notes of this episode. So it'll be at the top of the show notes. There'll be links all over the place. You'll be able to follow Bob. You know Bob. And if you want to send some questions, you can send them to Bob. You can send them to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. And then we're still going to keep going with the Everyday Feast Day Fader Knives Chef Knife that has been going great. 10% goes to Sparrow's Nest. It's an awesome charity that we're really, really proud of. They've been going great. We're going to keep the ball rolling, and we're probably going to be adding on another piece to the set. I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say, yes.
Okay, we got to work on the details.
We're excited. We're having fun.
We're having fun. We're having fun. All right, guys.
Yeah.
Listen, go follow Bob. Go follow his podcast. Share this podcast where you do your social media to help, what is it called? Echo the sentiment. You know what I'm saying? Bob, I cannot thank you enough. You're fantastic. I love everything you do, and I appreciate your time and energy.
Likewise. I appreciate it. I appreciate people for listening. I mean, thankful is the word, I think.
There you go.
Grateful,
guys. We didn't even get to your Grateful Dead t-shirt phase. That's for next,
oh my
next
goodness.
Week. People are asking about your Grateful Dead t-shirts. We'll do that the next time. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Bob, thanks so much for your time, and we'll see you next week. Thanks again, Bob.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks so much.